From NPR, this is Hearing Voices.
Smith corks one into right down the line. It may go. Go crazy, folks. Go crazy. It's a home run, and the Cardinals have won the game by the score of 3-2 on a home run by the Wizard. Go crazy.
Welcome to Home Team, a Hearing Voices special supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm your host, Gwen Maxey, from WBEZ series Resound. And I've got a full roster of baseball stories from the Public Radio Hall of Fame. But first, let's spend a minute with this guy.
My name is Robert Logan. I'm a vendor at the stadium in St. Louis. St. Louis. If you ever down that way, you come on in to see me. Come on in to see me. Hey. Come on in to see me. If you ever down that way, just hear me say, hey, you might just hear me say, hey, this is your wishy-wishy beer man. Hey, this is your wishy-wishy beer man. Hey, this is your wishy-wishy beer man. Wishy-wishy. Wishy-wishy. You might just hear me say, this is what I do.
The Bushy Wishy Rag, composed by Philip Bimstein and performed by the Equinox Chamber Players of St. Louis. The Cardinals announcer is Jack Buck. Robert Logan is the beer man.
So come on in and enjoy baseball in St. Louis.
Okay, so everyone wants to be in the majors, and I don't mean just baseball. But realistically speaking, isn't it safe to say we're all pretty much in the minors? Three strikes, shutout, the penalty box, the flagrant foul, the squeeze play, the curveball, the changeup, seventh inning stretch, sudden death? Let's just say I could go extra innings listing life as sports metaphors. Well, in the minors, the pay may not be as good, but as you'll soon hear, you're in excellent company. Coming up, Rookie League, a service in the Church of Baseball, and one of the single most humiliating moments of my life, caught on tape at the minors in Prince William County, Virginia. Stay with us.
Baseball. baseball. I love to see someone do great. Baseball. I never could play baseball. It's like I had two left feet. I would love to be out there playing it with them, you know. But I feel like I am part of the game by being right there in the stadium, watching them do it.
Every time I go to a baseball game, settling in for a long, lazy afternoon in the bleachers on a scorching summer day, I make sure to get there in plenty of time to watch the crowd quiet down as a lone singer steps out to a lone microphone poised to sing this country's national anthem. I like the drama and ritual of it all, even if I never know all the words. The players are standing with their caps over their hearts, and everyone turns toward the outfield where the flag is luffing in the gentle summer breeze. There's a brief moment of silent anticipation. In that moment, before she sings, I always wonder the same thing. What would it be like to be her? And then I think, I could do that. Turns out, it wasn't even that hard to arrange. A few phone calls, and the gig was set. I was set to sing the national anthem for the Prince William Cannons on Friday, July 8th. I practiced in the shower, I practiced in the car, and most importantly, I learned the words. The day of the performance arrived, and I sang all day. I knew I had to start low so as not to completely humiliate myself on those high notes. I was just getting into the shower when the phone rang. It was a guy from the Cannons calling to tell me the bad news. There'd been a scheduling mix-up, and, well, I'd been bumped for an Elvis impersonator. We rescheduled, and they stuck me with a Sunday afternoon, the last home game of the season. It was 95 degrees, and the sun was so hot, it felt like someone was ironing the back of my neck. I was fine, cool, and collected, until I got to the stadium. Little boys were hanging on the fence, waving their arms for autographs. Vendors were pounding the bleachers, shouting, "Beer here!" Suddenly, my heart started beating like a wild conga, and my muscles twitched in every direction. I felt like I was about to meet my maker.
Good afternoon, once again, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the staff and management of the Prince William Cannons, we welcome you to County Stadium and this afternoon's ball game. It's time to feel the firepower of Prince William Cannons baseball.
My eyes were transfixed on the microphone. Start low, I thought, start low. I watched each player jog into position as the crowd whistled and cheered. There were 7,000 people there. I felt myself watching myself, separating from the here and now. I was floating in my own body, suspended in time and space. It felt like I was actually participating in my own dream.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, would you please rise, take off your caps as we honor America with our national anthem, as performed by Quinn Nexeye.
I started too high.
Early light, what so proudly we watched.
Watched? watched. It's hailed. Hailed. Everybody knows that. As soon as the word came out of my mouth, I saw the pitcher snap his head to look at the first baseman. I could see a cartoon-like thought bubble actually appear over his head. It read, "Where do they get these people?" And still, words just kept coming out of my mouth. I just prayed they were the right ones. You get the point. Let's move on. It was over. I wandered back to my seat in a daze, wondering if they played Help after every performance of the national anthem, or if it was meant for me personally. I really wanted to sing like Marvin Gaye or Mariah Carey, like I do in my car, late at night, all alone. But instead, I spent my 90 seconds of fame sweating, quivering, and squeaking. I felt like everyone in the stands would be laughing hysterically and pointing at me. Then I opened my eyes and realized that I was the farthest thing from these people's minds. As far as they were concerned, it was just another ball game. As far as I was concerned, my biggest accomplishment of the day was single-handedly proving true the words of Metropolitan Opera manager Rudolph Bing when he said, "How nice the human voice is when it isn't singing."
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
When you go to a major league ball game, like any pro game, or pro anything for that matter, some things just seem painfully obvious. Even though the players are standing just a few hundred yards from you, they seem miles and miles away. But in the minors, everything is so much more accessible. Tickets are cheap and easy to come by. The atmosphere is relaxed and congenial. Players are happy to see the kids waving the programs, which they very well may stop to sign. We can actually see ourselves on that field. Imagine what it would be like to be one of them. Our next piece, Rookie League, by producer Barrett Golding, is a great illustration of how major the minors really are.
Here we go. All right. Swing down and hit a line drive, not a ground ball.
This is where it all starts. This is where everybody, managers, players, umpires, get, for the most part, their first taste of professional baseball experience.
All right, close. About three more, Terry.
The big thing about the Rookie League is that kids are coming in for the first time. You know, here there are kids that are playing high school and college, and they have to learn how to adapt to playing every day. They have to learn how to get on a bus at 12 o'clock at night and get there at 4 o'clock in the morning and play the next day. And so actually for 2.5 months, what they're doing is they're getting acclimated to professional baseball.
That high strike, well, that's the one you can do it on. Swing down, hit a line drive. There!
It's basically guys anywhere from 18 to 22, 23. Once they're 24, they can't play in this league anymore, and hopefully they make an A-ball team or a double-A team, and if not, they go get a lunch pail.
Where's that pitcher over there?
As long as they put a uniform on like we are here today standing in Helena, Montana, there's a chance to get to the major leagues, and as a manager, I've got to keep them aware that there is a chance.
I don't think there's one kid on this team or any kid in any rookie league that you can write off. You know, the scouts do a great job. They're all here for a reason, and that reason is that they can play.
The apex of the top of the triangle, I want you to catch the ball at the apex of its bounce.
I played in the Dodger organization. I played 11 years, 8 years with the Dodgers.
I signed with Pittsburgh Pirates right out of high school in 1951.
Until in 1964, I was the manager there.
And spent 17 years coaching in the big leagues. And when they made the big changeover in the ownership in San Diego, they let 32 of us go.
I lost my job with the Giants, and then I kind of sat around a year.
You never know from one year to the next where you're going to be.
Well, I went to work. The Brewers assigned me to a Japanese club, the Yamayuri Taiyo Whales.
That is kind of the nature of the game. The manager would get fired, and I'd get fired along with him sometimes, and you know, then you change.
Gorgeous afternoon. We had a little breeze when the game started. It died. The flag is hanging up on the flagpole. It was a little cloudy most of the day, but it has cleared off. Couldn't ask for a nicer night for baseball.
From the press box, you can see the state capitol, the Catholic Cathedral, Mount Helena.
There's not a more beautiful setting in the Northwest or really in the country for a baseball park.
Baseball is my favorite. Yeah, I've been going to games since 48.
I missed 5 games out of 35 2 years ago. I had heart surgery, 4 bypasses. So I missed the last 2 games.
Rocket Fred,
come out here and you see these kids the first night. Good-looking young guys, probably half scared to death, away from home.
I pitch. I'm a starter. I signed about 4 days ago, and this is the first pro baseball I've ever done. You know, and now I'm about ready to start my first game. Got the queasy stomach. Never been this nervous, I don't think, playing baseball.
For the land of the blind and the free.
This is my first year. I've been playing baseball. I'm 23 now. I've been playing since I was 5.
I was 12 years old when I made that decision that this is what I want to do, and I'm not the only one.
And here we go for the first inning. Scores 2-1. Everybody's pitching. He hits. It's a foul.
Ball down the left field line. He can foul secrecy. Chase dives, but cannot get to it.
I love being out here outside. I love the crack of the bat, the fans booing and screaming and yelling.
It doesn't always sound like strike, you know, it's just the words that come out when you say it.
Make it look like you actually believe that pitch is a strike so that everybody in the ballpark, the players on the bench, all believe, oh, geez, that must have been a strike.
You got to make a decision. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. If anybody... any umpire ever tells you they never miss a call, they're lying. I love it. I figure they paid their $5 to sit there, let them yell at me all they want.
The pace of the game lends itself so that people can become distracted and watch the mountains, talk about what was in the newspaper, let their kids run around the stadium chasing foul balls and make themselves sick buying snow cones. Baseball, you can glance at the scoreboard once in a while and still kind of keep up with the game.
Well, I like the team that I'm rooting for to win.
I've been to a couple major league games and they swear a lot and I'm not that kind of person that likes to hear swearing. And here, you know, you can make a lot of friends.
I adopt them.
You take pictures of all
take
the
pictures of all the Helena birds.
Makes an album, each year of them. She gives each one an album.
It's a hobby of mine.
Hobby of hers. She got it for you.
It's something to do for me.
Baseball is an excellent sport. Because there's cute guys.
They're tight uniforms.
Number 11.
11, yeah.
Unique name and Twinkle Toes.
I've always loved baseball. My dad's from back east, and he's always loved baseball, and I think I just inherited it, you know. It's kind of a father-son sport, you know what I mean? And there's a heart in this game, you know. There's a love. Whereas in football, it's just to go get him, you know.
I'm Jerry Salzano, Sr., and this is my wife, Joanne, and that's Jerry Salzano, Jr. He signed as a 17-year-old. He's been playing baseball since he's been about 4 years old and just always played it just about every day. I'd take him out and hit him ground balls, 200 ground balls a day all summer long. And his mother had a big input. She's not talking, but her father was a professional baseball player. He played with the Boston Braves.
Bobby Powell's father from New Jersey. This is my vacation. And he's doing very good, in my opinion. This has always been his wish, to play professional ball. He always played good and hard. He got no complaints from people, teachers, coaches, that he's a good boy out there. I've watched Bobby ever since Little League. So I've always been there for Bobby, whatever he attempted to do, same as my other children.
My name is Bobby Powers from Bayonne, New Jersey. Second year with the Helena Brewers. My father and my little sister came out to see me play because my father's a big, he loves the way I play, and he's very proud of me and what I've done. And he came out and watched me in every high school game and helps me when I'm in the fall, keeping me in shape, making sure I eat well. And if I need him, I know he's always there for me. And all I have to do is give him a call, and he'll back me up 100%.
Option for a called strike, 0-2. Brewers haven't had a hit since Bobby Powers' single back in the second inning. Pocatello beat Lethbridge today. Billings at Butte rained out, and no report in yet on Idaho Falls at Medicine Hat.
You figure there's 23 guys in this ball club right now. Maybe two or three of them maybe will get to the big leagues. There's countless thousands of minor league baseball players, and most of them don't make it.
The only reason to do this is to get to the next level. This is not a career. This is fun, but the next level, the major leagues, is all there is.
Long way up to the big leagues, long way up. If you work hard and get a little bit lucky and you open some eyes, that's how you get there.
A lot of guys, you know, dream of having the opportunity to play baseball, and you know, that was my dream, and I'm just going to try to make the most out of it.
Rookie League by producer Barrett Golden. We're back in a minute with some meanings of the word dugout when we continue with Home Team from HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
The easiest way to describe our next story may be to describe what it isn't rather than what it is. The story is called Dugout, but it's not about the crack of the bat, the soft puff of air blowing onto the field on a hot summer night, the fans, the hot dogs, be you here? It's about two people, their present, their history, their lives, and their dugouts. A little about the literal dugout where baseball players wait to bat, but more about the figurative dugout where we're all waiting for something to happen. Or maybe the kind of dugout where you're under something and need to escape. Dig out. The piece was written, composed, and produced by Terry Allen in 1993 for New American Radio series, produced by Helen Thorington and Regina Beyer. The piece is going to take us to the end of the hour. Let's listen to Dugout.
An empty room, dead center. She's sitting in the only chair. Roses lay in her lap and make a pile like blood around her feet. Four windows, one in each wall, are open. Wind blows every curtain straight out. White as sheets of ice, rigid and parallel with the floor. Only her fingers move, easily and in a rhythm, like she is playing the piano. Her mouth is painted. She smiles, red. And you can almost breathe the goddamn St. Louis blues.
Dugout.
He was sitting in the backyard looking at his hands. They were huge and gnarled, ancient. Every finger had been broken more times than he remembered. Every knuckle jammed into knots. Every bone in each shattered, splintered, and cracked in two. She watched him from the window and came out, thinking he was sad. "What are you thinking about, honey?" He looked up at her, then grinned. "I was thinking about all of it, every damn second. How I wouldn't trade any of it for nothing." 6 months earlier, they told him it was hopeless. The cancer was all over his body. She was with him and held his hands. He looked down, then at her, then at them. "Well," he said, "I guess that's the way the ball bounces." This was in the spring, 1959.
He flew out in a great high arc through the air. He was 6 years old and landed in the Missouri River. "Swim, you little sumbitch, swim or drowned," his pa's voice giving the lessons. So he did, paddling like a dog and hating that voice and hating that water and running the two together inside his life forever, but forever also, never forgetting the shocking joy of that sudden flight through the air in the great high arc. And back on the banks, the first true knowing that he would never doubt his own body again. Whatever hell happens now, the little sumbitch can swim. His pa's voice in the year 1892.
Outside, a half dugout stuck half in and half out of the side of a small Oklahoma hill. The air is black with dirt, and the year is 1905. Inside, a large man looks down and clenches his fist over a wood box that holds a newborn baby girl. Her mouth is open in a tiny black scream, and the blood of birth still runs off her body. He stares at the tiny, wet, red sex. This is three of what will be his five children, and he would strangle it right now if his wife wasn't there watching him, weak but smiling. He thinks it is wicked and godless, a creature of the devil, and he will wrestle with that in his heart the rest of his life. Outside, if there is sound, it is something jagged and metal, banging and tinkling with the cries in the wind.
The doctor pounds on the door. A blizzard slams daggers into the north wall of the house. He was 8 years old and his neck was swollen big as a bucket. The doctor stomps his boots three times and walks over and looks right down his mouth. "They gotta go," he says. His pa puts a long black iron poker on the fire. His ma looks at him from over her shoulder, where she stirs lye with a big wooden ladle. When the poker glows, his daddy calls his brother. "Help me hold a little sumbitch down." They hold him, and the doctor shoves the glowing poker slow and deep into his throat and burns out his tonsils. His body went rigid from the pain, but he didn't make a sound. He just pictured the giant spoon whirling around in the lye. "Boy's got some bark," the doctor says before he leaves. A week later, his neck was down, but his mouth is still blistered shut. After that night, he never said more than he had to anybody. This is in Missouri on a farm in the winter of 1894.
Outside, she is 5 years old, and it's the Texas Panhandle of 1910. She wears a white dress and is sitting on the front seat of a covered wagon. The papa sits beside her holding the reins to two mules in one hand and a bullwhip flying from the other. His face is dark and furious, and the whip curls out of his fist like a snake. Deep bloody trenches groove across the animal's backs. She's looking away from him at her brothers and sisters skipping beside the wagon in the tall grass. Her hand covers her mouth, and her eyes are huge, like she's giggling. Inside, the mama sits on a wood box sewing. She has a sweet angelic set to her mouth. Her hair is up in a tight bun. In her lap is a hand-tinted photograph of a three-year-old. The girl is in a white dress. The eyes are huge, with black rings around them, and the mouth is frozen, curved downward, deep, blurred, and terrible. If there's sound, it's the mama humming. In the sweet by and by. That beautiful show. It is 1958. They have been together longer than they were ever with anyone else. It is late at night. They lay in separate beds and talk about their lives. The stories come up one by one, and great spaces open up and move in and out between them. She says a person has to dig into the heart of everything, and what little gets dug out is all there is, or will ever be. He says he remembers every game. She says she remembers every single song, and it no longer is just about the two of them. It's all of it, most of which can never be said. It just lays in secrets in the dark, like the black gap between the two beds that holds their hands. It has nothing to do with growing old.
A lot happened in the summer of 1895. In May, he never went back to school after the third grade. The teacher ran off with a ball player from St. Louis. He didn't know what a ball player was, but he knew he liked him. Teachers were scarce in Missouri. In June, he got his first ball glove. His pa, mystified by the unusual configuration of the thing, traded a plug of tobacco for it from a tonic drummer. He thought it to be a cushion or perhaps some kind of hat. He tried out various other speculations on it, none of which worked worth a damn. So he said to hell with the sumbitch and threw it in the barn. The boy found it. He didn't know what it was, but it set well with him. He liked holding it and looking at it. He liked the feel of his fingers inside it. In July, his older brother, who'd never told him nothing, told him it was a ball player thing, a catcher's mitt, and then told him the ball being played was called baseball, a game made up by the famous Mr. Thomas Alva Edison during one of his rest periods in between inventing the electricity light. Things snowballed after that. By August, he'd seen his first exhibition game at a county social, had begun to practice diligently and learn most of the basic rules, and before the first blue norther hit in late September, had already played in 25 seven-inning games. He didn't care who invented it. He knew he could do it, and he knew it beat hell out of farming. Can't hit for shit, but the little sumbitch can throw. Even his pa learned the game.
Inside, the papa is down on his knees, big hands thrown out before him, crushed white with prayer. But his head is up, twisted, rigid to the right. His mouth is wet, and his eyes bulge with revelations. A full-bodied woman is playing the piano. Her dress is black, and he's studying her ass move on the bench. The church is nearly empty. If there is sound, it is hissing. Outside, steam spews from the engine. The platform's mobbed with people and banners wave. A brass band is playing. Two blacks jump high, kicking their heels in the air. They both look like Uncle Sam and hold tiny flags. Blue smoke hangs over the barrels of pistols. The boys are on the train, jammed out the windows, waving and leaning to kiss the girls. Every mouth is wide open.
Your pa spent 3 days down in a dugout dirt trench full of blood up to his chin. Couldn't even raise his head because there was more lead shot in the air than there was air. Said in a field once after a fight, he seen more human guts laying in the dirt than there was blades of grass. So let him be, boy. He'd dogged his pa about it, dogged him about the war, but he'd clam up, just go on about whatever he was doing, or walk away. But he kept dogging him. Finally, his ma jerked him up by the arm and carried him off into the field. He weren't no murdering red-legged trash like that James clan. He served with honor with the Tennessee Volunteer. Three of his brothers warred for the Yankees, but your pa and his baby brother warred for the cause. Day they left, they stood right out there in town road, solemn as preachers, and shook hands. Shook hands and went off different directions to kill one another, brother against brother. Them was dark days. When they left, their own pa, your grandpa, was so disturbed he killed their ma, shot her in the heart, then killed his own self with a ball in the mouth. Whole family got killed, except your pa. And he wouldn't say nothing, nary a word, for 4 years after he come back from it. I'm the only one he ever talked it to. And after it was all out, he said, "That's it. It's out, and it's over, and it's dead. And I ain't saying it air to no living soul again." So, boy, let him be. Them was terrible dark days.
Inside, her tongue is hanging out. Her eyes are blank. She is naked, spread-eagled in a broken bundle of hay. A pair of bloodied knickers lay in a wad near the stall. The livery is empty, except for one pale horse. Deep red welts bubble up along her arms, her throat, across her stomach, and the insides of her legs. Strings of vomit pool and cake across her flat, bony little chest. She is 13 years old and drunk as a skunk. Outside, a photographer covers up his head and looks out the camera. Up close and centered to the left, the shadow of a figure running is blurred, black against the wooden slats outside a livery. In the middle, and slightly to the bottom, a crowd of people wave at a great black train covered with flags pulling away. In the distance, far to the right, near the top, the dark silhouette of a man in a flatbed wagon with what appears to be a piano tied to the back. Even at this distance, the man seems excited, frantic even, as he whips a horse whose head is lost, disappeared off into the edge. Inside, the photograph, sepia-toned and centered with a white border on black paper, held with tiny black corners glued down with spit. At the bottom, someone's written in small but elegant script, "Summer of 1918, our boys go to war." And under that, in the same slanted hand, "While they take their leave, we make the windows slick from crawling out at night. If there's sound, it's a piano." It is 1957. He is at the kitchen window. She has been gone 3 days. He never knew what to do. He just waited. He knew she was probably out drinking. The piano in the living room was not enough. He understood it. She was a lot younger than him, but he still had the feeling, so he waited. Sooner or later, she always got home.
He squatted down and looked at it. His dog was hung up in the fence. The face was gone except for one eye and part of the head. The part with that spot like a musical note. The dog had got tangled up in the wire and cut off all the blood to three of its legs. They'd gone green and big as gourds by the time he'd found it. He loved the dog, but had shot it straight away. He didn't even pet it. Years later, it turned into a bedtime story. "Daddy, tell me again about that dog." So he'd sit down on the edge of the bed in the dark and tell what a fine dog it was, till his older brother had murdered it. And he'd tell this brother said he'd found the dog all hung up and suffering, so he shot it out of its misery. But tell he never believed a word of it because his brother was a damn born liar and had also always hated the dog anyway. Then say he'd never liked his son bitch brother ever since. And end the telling by saying the only one of his brothers he ever did care anything about at all was the younger one who got his head knocked off in a car wreck in 1930. My real brothers played ball. Then it was good night and the door shut behind him. The only bedtime story he ever knew. But back then he just squat down and looked at it. He was 12 years old, and it was 1898, and Teddy Roosevelt had just whipped Cuba. Later, he walked back to the house, and his pa was butchering a hog, his ma spooning out the brains into a frying pan. Fighting a bunch of Mexicans ain't no war. Hell, it ain't even no fight. Missionary Ridge and Lookout Mountain, them was fights. His pa was muttering. It always made him jittery to kill stuff. Over supper, he told them about his dog. His brother laughed.
In 1922, she sits at the piano. She's 17 years old. The woman in black from church sits with her, very close on the bench to her right, pointing at notes. She leans away from the woman, far left toward the low end. The woman has huge breasts and will only teach hymns. She's a sweet person, but a religious fanatic. God is always swarming out her mouth. She has hideous breath. Later in nightclubs during the 1930s, she'll giggle. Kid, this is why I always play way down at the bottom. Every time I go up past Middle C, I can still smell that old Biddy's breath. And it was true. Down in the bottom, her left hand could raise the dead. But not all true, because on the high end, her right hand made the dead men dance. It was solid, pure, creased lightning. In 1923, she catches the papa and the woman in black by surprise on the love seat in the parlor. She's tickled, but she never tells. In 1924, the woman in black helps her get a scholarship to a religious school far away. It's a music college in Dallas, secretly endowed by the Church of Christ and probably the Ku Klux Klan, she says later. In 1925, she discovers jazz. 1 month later, she's expelled for getting caught playing barrel house piano in a juke joint down in Deep Ellum. "Who caught me?" she said. A dean of discipline tells her she is the first young lady ever expelled from their institution. "This jazz is a terrible wickedness," he says, "but a white girl playing it with Negroes is unspeakable." When he hears about it, the papa will cut deep slashes across the tops of his hands with a razor. He cries all night. It was awful. And she was thrilled. 6 weeks later, she's enrolled in beauty school in Fort Worth, has a waitress job, and is rehearsing her own band. She is 20 years old.
They'd come late at night, all through the late 40s and early 50s. They'd come scratching on the screen, pounding on the door, shooting fireworks off in the yard. Old ball players and old musicians come to tell their stories. She would cook and giggle and play the piano like a house on fire, and they would all sing and drink and talk loud and colorful around the great deep gaps inside of their lives. And when it was over, they would all hug each other and cry, then get in their cars and drive away. They'd come late at night, turning their memory into a story, until 1955. After that, most of them were dead.
Outside, a baseball diamond. There are no foul lines. The invention of foul lines will change the game. Men who can hit on the extreme left or extreme right will be eliminated for those who can hit within the confines. Foul lines are the last great change, much more than lights. But this is before that. The newest invention on this day are two narrow rectangles cut into the ground, one approximately 20 feet off the first base side, one approximately 20 off the third base side. Each are about 3 feet deep and have a flat wooden bench running the length of the trench down inside. They have been invented for the player's comfort and safety while they are not on the field of play. They look like graves, and for several years will be called just that. When the game is over, they will be deep with blood, spit, whiskey, tobacco, and mud. Inside, he's sitting on the bench. The year is 1903, and he is just grounded out to short. He is in Enid, Oklahoma, catching his first game with the farm club for the great St. Louis Browns. He is 17 years old, and it is probably the happiest day of his whole life. In the grave, his first dugout.
Colorado and Prohibition are in full swing.
She's 28 years old at the piano. She has long black hair and a red sequin dress. The speakeasy's full of ball players. Her band's long gone. She's smoking a cigarette and plays alone in the lounge. She doesn't care much for sports, but the players are nice. Some of them are kind of dumb, but they tip good. Her day job's playing an old ragtime upright at the last silent movie house in Denver. Sound has taken the world by storm. She isn't licensed to do hair in Colorado. She's trying to get home to Texas.
They only had one baseball in Enid. It was a cheap club. If somebody hit a long one out over the outfield, they had to stop the game and both teams go hunt for the ball. There weren't any fences in Oklahoma, just weeds. He'd been a busher now going on 6 years. All his fingers were broke 100 times, but he stayed in the game. He had seen the great Ty Cobb once, saw him take out a second baseman with high spikes in the face. The whole infield was covered with blood. It impressed him. That's the only way the game is played, with heart and for blood. Nobody made any money.
She is on the rebound from her second husband, a drunk newspaper man who swept her off her feet in Dallas and took her to California. It went straight downhill for 5 years. She didn't mind the liquor, even tolerated a black eye now and then, but she had despised the jealousy and left. Her first husband is dead. She drinks some now herself. She misses her band.
They meet at the railroad station. He's a lot older, but she likes his big open grin. "Hi there, sunshine," she says. Instead of going on where they were going, they go to supper. They like each other's hands. She is recently divorced and his first wife recently dead. It is the summer of 1942, and as usual, America is at war. They are married 6 weeks later. He gives her a small ring with tiny diamonds. She gives him one son. They will live together 15 years. Both of their lives will never be what they are again.
When the season was over, he had to find work. Mostly he did carpentry or sold hardware. One winter he worked in a slaughterhouse. He hated the pigs screaming and quit after 3 days. He never ate bacon again. He started collecting spoons as souvenirs from all the towns he played in. They had little pictures of famous landmarks on them. At night, he'd lay them out on the bed in the hotel and look at them. It always made him feel better. He saw the first electricity light, the first horseless car, the first aeroplane, and many other first-time gadgets. He thought they were all just play pretties. "None of them will stick," he said. He was 32 years old when he finally went up to the majors, the summer of the Great War of 1918. He could still catch like a wall and throw like fire, but he couldn't hit. It was the damn foul lines. He was up for only 1 year, then shipped down to Houston. They made him a player manager because of his age, so he ended up making a name in the Texas League. During the 1920s and 30s, it was the meanest of them all.
The Denver Post tournament is in its third day. She has a date to the game with the sax player. From the bleachers, she watches a woman in a black dress down the money seats lean over the wire and kiss a big, rough-looking catcher. It's her old piano teacher. "God, I hope he's holding his breath." She gets so tickled she pees her pants. That night in the lounge, she sees the two of them again. She's playing and they're dancing, and for some reason, the moment is so perfect, she just tears up the goddamn St. Louis Blues. The name of the speakeasy's on the wall behind her in glittery letters. It says the Satin Dugout. But the Denver cops naturally call it the foul line.
He married a Catholic woman. He was mystified by the religion, but seldom saw her. When he wasn't playing or managing ball, he hopped freights. He said it was to find work, but mostly it was just to go see something else. She died of cancer of the throat in 1940. Once he told a young busher with a promising arm, "Your life just turns into a bucket full of stories with a little bitty hole in the bottom."
Or a bucket full of holes with a little bitty story in the bottom, she told him years later, giggling. He is cussing the Yankees. It's the final game of the World Series. He is cussing the television. Baseball should never have been put on television. He cusses the players. All they care about is the money. The pitchers take forever to throw the damn ball. She can hear him from the kitchen. His brother is with him. He says he has come to say goodbye, but she doesn't like his eyes or the way they look at her. She pours a small whiskey. The Yankees win. The television is off. The game is over. He is 73 years old. He talks 2 hours with his brother. The brother will never mention what was said. She comes in and takes his hand. It's time. Her fingers move lightly over his big knuckles like she is playing the piano. He feels himself suddenly come loose and fly out in a great high and familiar arc. And in some infinite and secret place, she flies away with him.
Dugout was written and produced by Terry Allen. The voices are Terry Allen, Joe Harvey Allen, and Katie Marie Kuntz, with music performed by Richard Bowden, Lloyd Maines, and Terry Allen. Recording engineer was Alan Crosswell at Caldwell Studios in Lubbock, Texas. Dugout was commissioned by New American Radio with support from the National Endowment for the Arts. New American Radio is on the web at somewhere.org. I'm Gwen Maxey from the WBEZ series Resound.
I love baseball.
At ChicagoPublicRadio.org.
I love baseball.
From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.